Welcome to At a Crossroads with a Naked Podcaster, where we bear it all spiritually and emotionally. I'm your host, Jen Taylor. Each week on the podcast, I'll bring you an inspiring message to support you in designing and creating a vibrant, fulfilling life. Before we dive in, please visit the Facebook community in the links to ask questions that I can answer during this live podcast. At a Crossroads with a Naked Podcaster is for those of you who know that there is more to life and that our true, authentic souls are built for greatness. You are built with strength and love that is meant to shine through in times of conflict and in times of celebration. Welcome. I cannot wait to bear it all with you. In my business, I coach Christian women to step into who they are meant to be, inspired by their purpose and God-given gifts. Find the link in the description to join my private Facebook group. I can't wait to see you there. Let's get started. Hello. Today, I'm so excited. And I have John McLernan on, and he made me laugh so hard right before we started this live. So I was trying to maintain my composure like I'm the little icon. So I wanted to make sure I was pronouncing your name correctly. So I said, it's McLernan. And you said,
if McDonald's had a school and I was a student, I'd be McLernan.
And I don't know why that was, you know, there are sometimes people you hear something and it's like pee your pants funny. That was it. So welcome.
Hey, thank you so much. I love laughing and I love dad jokes as well. So yeah.
Yes.
So I thought maybe we could warm them up with one.
Yes.
So when does a dad joke become a dad joke?
I don't know when.
When the punchline becomes apparent.
Oh my gosh. Okay, so I have a daughter who's 21 and she is like I know it's a dad joke, but she is like the queen of dad jokes, right?
Perfect.
So every time we hear one, we're like, stop, everybody stop. We've got to text this one to Gabby. So that's a text to Gabby. And I homeschool our sixth grader and her math tutor starts the math lesson off every day. And I would have never thought of doing this as a teacher, but I am so grateful that she does. It was a good lesson for me. She starts off every math class with like three jokes. So beginning of our day, every day is my sixth grader telling me these three dad jokes. So like it is such a part of my life.
That's amazing. I know they're dad jokes, but really they're not exclusive. Anybody can tell a dad joke as long as it makes you groan. My favorites are the ones that have like a hidden meaning that you can't, like the one I just told you, like you have to think a little bit about it and then it goes click. And that's what I love the most.
I love it. Okay. Well, that was super fun. And I like that it was unscripted. You've done this like 40 blah times in the last couple of months. You get interviewed a lot. Your story is really phenomenal. I'm very grateful to have you on. And we're right there banging on all cylinders. I want to talk about, first of all, every single one of your links to social media are in the description. And I just posted your free like discovery call. I don't know if you call it that actually, but
yeah, I call it a discovery call. I call it like let's chat. I mean, honestly, it's really about just two human beings talking to each other, me learning about them and saying, hey, am I a good fit to help you? Like, because that's really what it's about.
Exactly. I know I do a strategy call also, and it's not like we're not trying to figure out the answers to the universe. It's 30 minutes to see, can I help you? Are you a good fit? Am I a good fit for you? Or maybe is this about something different that I can assist you with? It's kind of like a virtual coffee date, right?
Yeah. I think people sometimes get like hung up on it and take it like very, very seriously. And I'm so relaxed and down to earth and sometimes even crack jokes on these, but it's like, really, I just want to know, like, where are you at that you're struggling? Where do you feel like you need some help? Am I the one that can help you bridge that gap? And if so, cool, we can talk about that. And if not, maybe I can point you in the right direction.
Yeah, me too. That 100%. I know people hear the word strategy call, those words, and it's like, oh, it's a sales pitch. Like, no, I know what I do. I'm real forward about what I do. You're really forward about what you do. And sometimes that is the phone call, and it shouldn't have to be a sales pitch because you know why you're here and I know why you're here. And other times it is just legitimately a conversation. So your website, let's jump into your website, freedomnutritioncoach.com.
That's and the one.
Yeah, I know. I'm very good at stalking with the links you send me.
That's good. So, it's always good to stalk your guests.
I know. I am following you everywhere. So, like, that's not creepy. Yeah. Your journey is so tied into your business. I've interviewed predominantly almost 100% entrepreneurs, and I learned very quickly in the process that 100% of entrepreneurs birth their business because of their struggle. And so they're always 100% connected, and some people more than other. So I really want to talk about what you do. What is Freedom Nutrition Coaching? I know you've been on several podcasts. What else is going on? You have different tabs, like you have a blog, Lifestyle 180, results about you. Jump in and tell me, and it's going to be more difficult for you to not share a lot of your story while you're sharing about this, but
fair enough.
you can figure that out.
Yeah. Well, kind of in a nutshell, the name came from what a client said to me: I don't want to live in nutrition prison anymore. And I was like, yes, that was quite a visual. You know, I say, I'm kind of an anti-diet coach, in a sense that, I had to ask the question, why are we so attracted to quick fix fad diets? And I think it's because we want to believe the promise, right? That weight loss is quick and easy, because it's quite an attractive idea. We don't really want to acknowledge that the reality of weight loss, if we want it to be permanent, is actually going to be quite a challenging thing. And, so I wanted to try to make that a little bit more accessible. And I don't talk about it so much on my website, but kind of I've coined this phrase, brain-driven weight loss. And really, what I'm trying to do with something like that is just shine a light on the fact that while what we eat and what we do in terms of activity matter, ultimately the driver of behavior is really our brain. And a lot of efforts to create change take this outside-in approach. I'm going to impose these rules and restrictions on you, and you're going to somehow try to force them into your life. And it's really our internal environment, whether that's our emotions, our mindset, our psychology, our habits. These are what most powerfully influence our behaviors and ultimately our results. And so I really wanted to try and tackle this from a different perspective. And yes, I'm sort of dodging a little bit of my own story, and I will say the topic around weight loss can be quite a sensitive one. And I try to say that weight loss is a doorway. It's not a destination. And I think I really want people to understand that it's actually just kind of this idea about a number on the scale is a placeholder for a future that we want to live in. You know, we want to feel comfortable in our skin. We want to, I call it shopping in our closet, you know, live life more fully with it, playing with our kids, hiking mountains, whatever it is, you know, it's kind of like the freedom to do the activity you want to do. And so if we could see it as something like it's actually an opportunity to experience life more fully, it's not about a number at all. And so that's kind of a coconut-sized nutshell overview of what drives me and what I do.
I want to address a couple things in that. And in my journey, personally, I have not had much issue with weight loss because I started off at 17 coming from a very unhealthy home. And it was my goal to not be in an unhealthy home myself. So I had to learn a lot. Having said that, I did go through traumatic surgeries at a miscarriage. And I know you said you have a 7-month-old, so you get the fact that, you know, pregnancy can be traumatic. But I had a hysterectomy after a miscarriage, and it was a very traumatic injury. And I put on 35 pounds in that process. That was more than I gained during a pregnancy. And then I was born in 70, so I'm turning 51. And in the last 2 years, I put on 20 pounds, not changing anything. So we can have very, very, you're male, so you have not gone through menopause. I am post-menopause, right? Yep. So we have all these different things. It can be poor eating. Weight gain can come from lots of different places. And even though I haven't had a tremendous amount of experience with it myself, this is what I found. And doing fitness competitions was the same. You said the word restrictive. It's interesting how our brain works that if you go on a food plan, and I don't even like calling them, I know that they are diets, but your diet is what you put in your mouth. Sure. Anything that you put past your lips and swallow.
Dieta is like the Latin word for it. Yeah.
Right. But when we put guidelines on our food plan, it instantly, our brain feels restricted.
Yeah.
Can you comment on that?
Well, human beings have a really strong sense of autonomy or desire for autonomy and independence. So when somebody comes to me and says, just tell me what to do and I'll do it, I go, let's talk about overwhelm. Because that's really what's happening here is right now you feel so overwhelmed, whether it's by your own life or by trying to find answers and just the conflicting answers. And your brain is going, I can't handle this. So let's try and simplify this. And so the desire to have a meal plan is really saying, I'm just too overwhelmed to even think about it. And it's like, okay, so the real problem that we need to address here is the sense of overwhelm that you're currently experiencing. And I always like to ask the question, how do you eat an elephant?
One bite at a time.
That's just it. And overwhelm is akin to trying to swallow the elephant whole. It's an impossible task. And so we see the magnitude of the challenge we're facing. And because usually the challenge puts us in some kind of pain or distress, it's our strongest desire to make it go away as quickly as possible, hence trying to swallow the elephant whole. And so this idea to take it one bite at a time can be a real challenge for people to come to terms with.
That's one of my favorite sayings. When people ask you for your favorite quote, that is like my number one favorite quote. It is true in almost every situation, that overwhelm, right? Yeah. I do like that. Just tell me what to do and I'll do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
I super like that. Let's do that one, right?
Well, I like to say that like overwhelm is trying to solve all your problems all at once in your head.
Right.
Yeah. And so. Yeah.
No.
Step one is get out a pen and paper and just start writing. Right. Just a brain dump. Just start clarifying the jumble that's taking place in your head. Because for as long as it's in your head. So what it is like we're trying to juggle so many metaphorical balls in our head, you know, and trying to keep them all in the air. And so then you struggle to sleep at night because you're like, well, I can't forget this. And I can't forget this. And I got this and this and this and this and this and so on. But I like to say that overwhelm is an emotion, not really a circumstance. Because ultimately, we can really only do one thing at a time. I know we talk about multitasking, but really it was task switching. We can do rapid task switching. Yes. And so overwhelm is only ever going to be in your head. Because in reality, all you can do is one thing at a time.
Right. I so agree with that. I tell my kids that all the time. I am very good at switching tasks, but you cannot split your brain between two. Yeah. Like stop trying. And I mean, I was probably guilty of this thinking, not only claiming that I can multitask, but claiming that I was great at it. And then realizing like, it's actually not super possible to do that. You can't really do that, but you can task switch quickly. And that was a much more exciting way to explain how my brain works.
Yeah. I think multitasking is in one sense overrated. And possibly a testament to the world that we live in that is throwing a lot at us. You know, you alluded to you know, without really making a lot of changes other than going through menopause. And while I won't hopefully go through menopause, something will go really strangely wrong with my biology.
If you do, call me back.
Yeah. Something's gone really wrong with my biology. although it is believed that there's such a thing as andropause, it's not well known or understood, but that men go through a hormonal shift transition partway through their life as well. Interestingly, I was actually a speaker at a menopause conference back in 2017. I was one of three males there. So it was the husband of the organizer, a photographer, and me, a presenter. And I was actually made the keynote speaker, which talk about being intimidated because I was 36 years old at the time. I'm like, oh my gosh,
wow!
I'm a 36-year-old male going to speak at a conference filled with menopausal women when I'm not an expert in menopause. And I've been given like a keynote slot here. And I actually got a standing ovation at the end of my talk and it was, pretty cool. Like it was very thrilling, but I learned so much about menopause listening to all the other speakers that day as well. It was really powerful for me to help because a lot of my clients are female, right? So it was really helpful for me to understand more of what the experience is. It's not a life sentence. You know, there's certain things you can do that can maybe make the experience of it less intense. Other things, if you do them, they're going to exacerbate the experience of it. And so it's really how do you navigate this experience ultimately? And maybe don't place too hard of expectations on yourself.
For me to wrap up menopause, it's similar to mammograms. I heard so many women complaining about how awful the experience was with mammograms and with menopause that as a woman, I'm like, oh crap, I don't want to do this really. Could we skip that? You know? And yeah. Then I remember having my first mammogram and thinking, okay, so that was it. Now, it could have been that in the past, the machine didn't work as well. I started getting mammograms at like 32 because of a family history. And I'm 50 now. So I've been getting 18 years of mammograms.
Right.
It's not a small amount. But I remember thinking 18 years ago, like, this is what everybody's complaining. Sure, it's not like the most comfortable thing I've ever done, yeah. but it's also yeah. not worthy of a complaint. And then I am postmenopausal now. At 51, postmenopausal, I went through it pretty young. I had 10, it was 10 years total. And again, I was like, you know, hot flashes and symptoms, they're not, you don't want to be like, oh yeah, I'll, you know what, throw in a couple more years of those hot flashes. That would be stupendous.
yeah.
At the same time, I really didn't feel like it was that big of a deal. So yeah. I think different women have different experiences, and also your attitude through it is a lot of what makes the experience better or worse for you. And I want to segue into a comment on your website that says, wait, now I don't want to get it completely wrong because I moved off of it. Diets suck, but you said fat loss doesn't actually have to suck.
Yeah.
So let's talk about that, because that seems like an attitude shift to me, but maybe it's also a technical shift too.
Well, yeah, because the idea of why I don't like diets, you know, the diet culture in a sense, is because it's really built on this idea that I will temporarily change my behavior and achieve a permanent result. Right from the get-go, you've set yourself up for failure, disappointment. Like there's, and then you're going to blame yourself. It's a myth to think that you can temporarily change your behavior and achieve a permanent result. That's just not going to happen. And so when you have that shift and you go, I actually have to change my lifestyle and change how I'm living.
Yeah.
And to kind of, I guess it probably makes more sense for me to kind of explain how I work with people.
Yes.
So I look at it like two experts collaborating. Okay, so I'm an expert in nutrition and psychology, but the person that I'm working with is an expert of their own life experience. And I need that input. I need that expert input in order to effectively work together. And so rather than treating it like I'm the expert and you're the dummy and you have to do what I say, I take a very collaborative relational approach to this. We are going to work together and you're going to have an active hand in this process. Because I want to empower you. It's super important that we actually empower somebody, because if all you do is follow rules that I tell you, the moment we're done working together and you take me away as a force acting on your life, everything collapses. But if I empower you and put it into your control, so we know the kind of the fundamental principles of a healthy lifestyle, like our biology is relatively simple in that regard. You know, quality sleep, difficult when you're a parent, but you do the best you can with what you got. Quality sleep, proactively manage your stress in some way, because we live in an inherently stressful world, especially mentally and emotionally nowadays. Quality nutrition, again, it's about do the best you can with what you got. Get some activity daily, stay hydrated. Like those are the kind of the core principles that would make up a healthy lifestyle. The question is, how do we shape them to suit your particular circumstances? And so that's what we're going to do, is we're going to say, hey, here's a starting point. We're going to start with this one principle. I want you to try and implement it in your life. And I want you to figure out where it works, where it doesn't, and what it triggers. And when you do, that's what we're going to talk about. But instead of you saying, I have to follow strictly this one rule that Coach John gave me, it's like, no, this is a starting point, and then we're going to adjust as we learn, so that you are now shaping it to fit your lifestyle. And then piece by piece, brick by brick, what we're actually doing is we are reverse engineering your healthy lifestyle, but you are actively shaping it. So at the end, you are fully empowered because you actually had a lot of control in this process with some guidance from me. And now you have a lifestyle that you love, that you have built actively instead of me telling you what to do. And because of that, your results are much more likely to stick, because along the way, we've also empowered you with education. So timely education, you know, not throwing a textbook at you and saying there's a test in 6 months. That's a terrible idea. But just timely bit by bit education, helping you to, here's why we're doing this. And in doing it in that way, I've found that it works a lot better than the way I used to work as a coach, which was to basically tell people what to do and kind of, you know, figure out why they weren't doing what I told them.
Exactly. So your story is really incredible. And I've loved talking to you about what you do now, but I really want to get into your story, because when people hear this, it's going to make such a world of difference in connecting with you. So let's jump back in time and jump in where you would like.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I was born in 82. So I was a child of the 80s. You know, what a time that was. I can imagine being a child of the 70s was actually probably pretty cool as well.
It was, because I got to live the 80s older than you did. Yeah, that was a blast.
Yeah. So you got to see some of the 80s that I didn't really get to form too many memories around. Cause I mean, I would have been already more than halfway through the 80s when I was really starting to form memories.
Yeah.
I had a bit of an exciting entry into the world. So I was born at 26 weeks.
Wow.
Yeah. So I was kind of an accident in many senses of the word. Failure of 1980s contraception. I have an older brother.
Okay.
And he's only 14 months older than me. That wasn't supposed to happen. My parents were hoping for a girl so they could have a pigeon pair. That didn't happen. And I showed up at home. My mom thought she had to go to the bathroom. And then it was like, uh-oh, something else is going on here. Now, I owe a huge debt of gratitude to my father, because he didn't freak out. I was born. He said kind of this mass came out. And he went... And all of a sudden, you can't really see my hands, but, you know, in one hand is, he's like, okay, which one's baby? Which one's placenta? You know?
Oh.
Yeah. Cause I wasn't much bigger than that. I was 2 pounds, 9 ounces. And then he's like, okay, you're blue, eyes shut, ears folded over. He said, he kind of looked like a little baby kitten. And so he got a syringe and unplugged my nose. And then he started doing CPR with his pinky finger.
Wow, John.
Yeah.
Okay. So in their 911 ambulance, something,
yes.
Anyone? Okay.
Yeah, that did happen as well, thankfully. But if it wasn't for my dad and his, because we lived about 45 minutes out of like Vancouver, and I was, this was, you know, you got to go to Vancouver is like a major city in the province I was born in. And it's like, that's, you got to go there. They're the only ones that have the ability to handle this early. Because in the 80s, you know, 26 weeks is pretty early. I mean, it still is now, obviously, but nowadays, yep. I hear that, you know, even 21, 22 weeks, it's viable that they can keep you alive, which is pretty incredible. But without my dad doing that, I likely would have had brain damage. I may not have even survived. And so his sort of calm presence of mind in that moment is why I'm here today. And so now, as I'm approaching 40, I kind of think about that story differently, because I heard it so many times. I was called a miracle kid. Like I was a 50-50 baby. Like they didn't know if I was going to make it. And I just kind of took it for granted because, well, I'm here. But now I'm a parent and I go, oh my gosh, like, okay, I can only imagine, you know? So it's really interesting because I spent the first 9 weeks of my life in NICU, this neonatal intensive care unit. And my mom's got just over a one-year-old, you know? And my dad's trying to run a business as an exterminator in the big city. And so like life is busy. And so they weren't necessarily able to get to me every single day. The nurses loved me, apparently. I think I'm very lovable. But I had these like chubby chipmunk cheeks, apparently. And so they gave me lots of love and doting. And I think that really helped. But ultimately, if you think about it, I basically spent most of my first 2 months of life lying flat on my back, hooked up to wires and monitors. And kind of sort of being held, but never held like that close, because they had to sort of keep me on oxygen and things like that. And I think that laid a really kind of independent streak, because there's a really important bonding time, if I understand correctly, between a mother and a baby, especially where there's that skin to skin contact, not just daily, but like hours and hours a day. You know, when my son was born, it was like, we made sure of it. We're skin on skin, you know, and my wife is just a beautiful mom. And I just love watching her and him together. I didn't really get that. And that's no fault of my parents. My parents are loving parents. They're wonderful people. I love them dearly to this day, 42 years married. Wonderful love story, really. But that meant that I had this really kind of fierce independent streak where I tried to do everything myself. Apparently I used to take my bottle, run behind the curtain and try and feed myself my bottle. when I was, you know, mobile enough to kind of scoot, I was like trying to take things and trying to do everything myself. So that kind of laid this independent streak. So we'll skip ahead, because I had a pretty happy childhood. You know, my life was good. My brother and I wrestled and were competitive, but like we're only a year apart, really, so we get along great. I went to university, studied chemistry, and got into nanotechnology research, which just means working on really, really tiny things. Nano is like, you know, really tiny, we'll put it that way. But I actually got bored. And I opted out.
Of course you did.
Okay. So I got bored, pardon me, and I opted out of the PhD program. I was being sort of groomed, not groomed is a terrible word, but anyways.
Yeah.
I was being lined up to enter into the PhD program because I was already a part of the research project. And I pulled the chute and joined the Navy because I needed a little more adventure and excitement in my life than standing in front of a fume hood. Anyone who's done chemistry will know what a fume hood is. Standing in front of a fume hood, mixing things, and then, you know, baking nanoparticles and shooting lasers at them to try and make them shoot lasers back at me. That's a bit of a simplification, but that was okay. That was kind of the process. So I joined the Navy, became a Marine engineer. For the first 3 years of being in the Navy, I was single, which is not a bad thing, because in hindsight, I would say the military breeds divorced alcoholics, and I don't want to, yeah. But in that time, I'd also met my future wife. There's a really cool love story in there in a sense too. Like, she's Australian. She got dumped in my lap one day in January. She'd met some of my friends in Vancouver, came over to my city called Victoria. That's on Vancouver Island. They said, hey, do you want to show this cute Aussie girl around? I was like, yeah, of course. I'm 20 years old and you got a cute Aussie girl for me? Okay. We spent 2 days hanging out, flirted, all that kind of stuff. But I thought I'd never see her again. I was like, oh, that was fun. Never thought I'd see her again. But as she left, she handed me a Gumtree, and a piece of paper said a Gumtree note from Michelle, and it had her Hotmail address on it. So I got
back
an email.
In the Hotmail days. It's not as bad as AOL, so it's okay.
Yeah. So I got an email address. MSN Messenger wasn't quite yet a thing, but right. we started communicating via, there was a chat called Trillion, and it combined AOL, ICQ, MSN, Yahoo Messenger, and one other one. And so I'd be doing all this chatting. When I was actually in the lab making nanoparticles, I'd be chatting with this Aussie girl on my computer because we didn't have smartphones back then either.
Right.
It's hard to imagine.
People can't even imagine that, but I remember those days. Okay.
Yeah. So that went on for about 2.5 years. We also got phone cards. We started communicating on the phone. And so her mom nicknamed me Sirius Like. Because at that point, like, neither of us kind of confided into each other that we both had a relationship happening at the time, because we were like just friends.
Right.
But I kind of knew that there was something going on there. And so I actually ended the relationship that I was in because I was like, okay, there's something more here. Her mom pointed out to her, said, you talk to your boyfriend for 15 minutes and you end up in tears. And then you talk to this guy from Canada for like 3 hours and all I hear is giggling and laughing. You know, there's probably something there. And so now this is, again, pre-Facebook, all this kind of stuff. So anyways, 2.5 years later from the time that we met, she's on a flight back to Canada. And it's July and it's Vancouver International Airport, huge airport, you know, millions of people milling about kind of thing. And I've only ever seen one picture of her. Because she didn't send me a single picture, this one picture. And I was like, how the heck are we going to know, like, who you are? And she said, I'll wear a colorful hat, is what she said. So I'm at the airport. And so, you know how when you leave customs, there's a little gap and then the doors open and you kind of walk out and you have to go around the barricade. And there's all these people holding signs and stuff like that. And it seemed, this is July, so it's just like the busiest day you'll ever find in Vancouver Airport. And I'm looking around and out comes this girl in a Tigger costume bouncing behind a trolley, pushing luggage. And I knew without a doubt, this was Michelle. And, but I couldn't get to her because of the crowds of people. There were so many people, but I could see, I was like, that's her. Like, and she has a whole story about like flying over and she had to carry her tail with her. Like, her mom made her this Tigger costume, you know, putting on her costume, like just outside of customs, and customs officer telling her, you can't open your suitcase here. And she's like, I got to put on this costume. You don't understand. This has been going on for 2.5 years and all this. And so anyways, she gets stopped. I'm trying to like wade through this crowd to like get to her. Cause I'm like, but she couldn't see me. And I guess she didn't really know who I looked like either. So someone stopped her to ask, you know, why she's wearing a Tigger costume. And she's thinking in her head, like, this guy better show up. Like, if this guy doesn't show up, I flew halfway around the world, put on a Tigger costume, you know. Anyways, and then she turns around, there I was, and she jumped into my arms, and we kissed, and everybody started cheering around us, and it was like a movie moment. So, yeah.
That's awesome.
It was pretty cool. And that was the start of a whirlwind romance. We got engaged, we flew to Australia, I got married over there. You know, I came back, did 3 more years in the Navy, and then decided it's no way to be married, because I was gone for like 280 days a year. And yeah, she's halfway around the world, away from her family, and her husband's never home. Like, so I came home one day and was like, hey, let's go teach English. And we didn't really have a plan. We're like, okay, cool. We packed everything into storage, hopped on a plane to Puerto Vallarta, so on the west coast of Mexico. Stayed there for a couple of days, and then we went inland to Guadalajara, which is a city of about 6 million people in central Mexico. Started teaching English down there. We stayed there for probably 5 months, and we actually met a guy from South Africa there who was doing the same thing. And anyways, there's kind of some cartel violence picking up. Like, Guadalajara has like the neighborhood called Zapopan, where a lot of the cartel heads have their mansions and stuff. And there was just like these tensions and more military and paramilitary presence in the streets and things. And we kind of just got a sense of, you know what, like, we're clearly not Mexican. And we stick a leg of sore thumb. Like, someone, one of our like other English speaking colleagues had been like sort of accosted by the police and robbed and stuff. We're like, you know what, like, it's getting a little, we need to get out of here. So we got jobs in Italy, took off to Italy, taught English for the summer. And then ended up getting jobs in Poland for the year. And our South African friend came over to Poland to teach English with us there, which is really cool.
Okay. Yeah.
So then, and I'm obviously I'm jumping quite a few details for the sake of time, but he had to go back to South Africa because he couldn't get his visa thing sorted out. And, the guy that owned the school that we worked with, he was like going to erase the stamp in his passport. Let's just erase the stamp and give the customs official a bottle of vodka. Like, no joke. This is, wow. You know, yeah. It works a little differently. Nowadays, it might be a little more difficult. This is going back about 10 years. Not that long ago, though, really, when you think about it. Anyway, so he was like, hey, why don't you come down to South Africa? And, you know, my parents run this organization, and it was basically teaching underprivileged youth life skills to sort of help with this unemployment crisis that they have among young people in South Africa. So teaching them life skills and then getting them placed in internships where they can apply these skills they've learned. So we're like, yeah, that sounds pretty cool. Mm-hmm. So we went back to Italy for like another summer, taught there, and then flew down to South Africa. And we started doing this teaching young people down there, underprivileged youth. It was this really, like, we loved it. It was a beautiful gig. We were out on a nature reserve. So there was an educational center, and just kind of like, this is like probably a couple hundred hectares, this thing. They've got rhinos and they've got other wildlife on there. and then you have like this little section, which is like the educational center. So we had that, a dormitory for students, kind of a washroom area, all in a line, and then off to the side, like an instructor's cabin. So kind of in an L shape. So this is going to factor into the story here. So it was one night, we were just wrapping up dinner with our students, and I decided to head back to the cabin early. It was a Monday night. And so I go back to the cabin, or I'm walking back to the cabin. It's dark out because it's August in South Africa. It's wintertime. And I kind of get outside my cabin, which is kind of tucked into the trees and bushes a little bit here. And I notice the door is slightly ajar. And that should have like twigged something in my head, but it didn't, because I mean, I was relaxed. I'm in flip flops and sweats and like just having a good old time. We're really connecting with our students. We love the work we're doing. Pardon me. And then I open the door and there's three guys in my cabin, and they're drinking rooibos tea, which is this, it means red bush, rooibos tea, and eating rusks, which is these hard biscuits that you dip in your tea. And I remember looking at them and I recognized one of the faces of those men, who was a ranger on this reserve. And so again, I was like, this is weird. Like, my brain wasn't quite like putting all the pieces together, because this isn't what I would expect to find on a nature reserve that's, you know, surrounded by fencing. It's got rangers, all this kind of stuff. Three guys busted into my cabin eating rusks and drinking tea. I didn't see the fourth guy. Fourth guy was outside the cabin, and the first hit across my head with a rock. And all of a sudden I realized, okay, this is bad. And I'm by myself. Like, everyone else is in a building. They're all having a good time, laughing, joking, making tons of noise. I am like a few hundred feet away, I just got hit across the head with a rock, and I'm trying to figure out like what the heck is going on now. And like blood starts streaming into my eye. And the other guys, they jumped up from the table. And I remember one of them, I had a collared shirt similar to this, and he grabbed like the collar of this shirt. And I just remember him smiling as he's swinging the rock at my head. And obviously in that moment I go, like, I can't die. That was the first thought that entered my head, is I can't die tonight. And, you know, I get hit across the head again, and, you know, I'm knocked down, like stumbling, I'm concussed, and now like bleeding profusely from my face because your forehead bleeds quite easily. And of course, they start kicking and stomping me as I'm like trying to struggle my way to my feet. Their objective was to beat me to death. And this is what happens in South Africa. It's I would say it's kind of a response to taking back something they feel was taken from them, and they feel like this is an appropriate way to do it, ultimately. And so in that experience, you know, I'm like screaming and trying to fight my way to my feet, calling for help. Nobody's coming. They're laughing. It was, you know, dark, but I'm a pretty big guy, and somehow I managed to get the strength to fight my way to my feet and kind of break free from them and kind of run, stumble, stagger my way over to the dining hall where everybody else is. And I don't know why they didn't chase me, truthfully, but they didn't for some reason. And so I like open the door, and like I'm covered in blood, and I've got like boot marks and all over my body, and you know, I've been attacked kind of thing. And then like pandemonium kind of erupts inside this building, because we actually don't know how many men are out there. They would often travel in packs of up to 10 to 15. And so a couple of other men went out actually and got some of the people that were in the dormitory and got them back into this building as well. And then we were like basically barricade ourselves in this building. And I have to say, like, my wife was immensely brave during all of this, because I'm like concussed and bloodied and like struggling to see straight and, you know, not even sure like what day of the week it is, where I am, or what's kind of going on. But I have memories of what's taking place here. And they started boiling water. They put a fridge against one of the doors. Like, the doors all and windows all have bars on them, because you're basically living in prison in there anyways. And these men are on the outside, and they started trying to break down the doors. They had shovels. They're swinging at these doors, trying to break them down and stuff. And we were basically trapped in this building for about 45 minutes with these men trying to like bust into the building. And it was only by a stroke of luck, one of our students had her phone with her, and we had just enough reception, and she happened to call the police station, and it happened to be a senior police officer walking by when the phone rang. Because the other thing is, in South Africa, the police are inept. They often become a police officer to collect a paycheck and basically try to avoid it, whatever they can, any kind of conflict, confrontation, whatever. So thankfully, it was a senior police officer that happened to walk by, picked up the phone, and dispatched somebody. But it's like a 40 minute trip from the city to get to the reserve. And when you enter the reserve, you go down into a valley and come back out. And it's nighttime, and you can see the flashing lights from 20 minutes away. So these guys saw the lights and kind of just melted into the bushes. And the cops show up. And I'd had a fork in my hand. Like, I guess I was going to defend myself with a fork. And I know.
Oh, my gosh. Isn't it crazy how your brain works? Okay, so you had a fork. Good job. You're front line.
And I was just hoping that, like, they didn't have guns, because they would have just shot through the windows and shot all of us. And they didn't have guns. They had knives. They didn't have guns. But, you know, and part of the story is, like, because I'm a Christian, and I was like, I can't die tonight because I don't think I'm saved. And that sounds like a, what would I say? Like an alarming statement to say as someone who's a Christian. But what I say is, in that moment, you know, like this, it's true that my life kind of, in one sense, was flashing before my eyes. There's a lot of things that was sort of running through my head as I'm fighting for my life and fighting for consciousness, really. But that I would say that I was a cerebral Christian. In other words, like, I'm really intelligent. I have a good memory. I can quote things, that kind of thing. I can say good things, but it was kind of what I would call like a head or a cerebral type Christianity. And it was because logically it made sense. And it was like in that experience, it was kind of shown to me that, like, you know, you've been weighed in the balances and found wanting, and there's a part of your heart service that's missing. And, so, you know, that was a really difficult experience to go through. And like, you know, like I said, my wife was incredibly brave. She was arming the women with like pots and pans and whatever she could find, and really kind of marshaling them around. Like, it was quite an experience. The fallout from that experience was, well, first of all, I mean, I started suffering from PTSD. And so reliving experience, flashbacks, flashes of rage, just a lot of things that I didn't want. You know, I'm a pretty easygoing, friendly, happy-go-lucky kind of guy who I'm pretty open-minded, and I love just what I hug just about everybody that I meet. Mm-hmm. And so to now be hit with like random flashes of rage, murderous, violent thoughts, it all felt like very intrusive. Part of it had a bit of an allure, I will say. After being traumatized and attacked by what I now know to be four men, and they beat a man to death the night before. And you know, in hindsight, when we came out there the Monday morning, there had been a helicopter flying overhead, but we didn't think anything of it, of course. Oh, they're just looking for poachers or something like that. The Monday morning when we went back to our cabin, because we left the reserve usually for the weekend, went back into the city and then came back out each week. I remember being like, the cabin's a little bit messy. Like, we'll just have to tell like the weekend facilitators to be a little more tidy when they finish up, so they don't leave it in a... Probably these men had actually been on the reserve already. They'd ransacked the place once. They knew that we were there because one of them was a ranger, so he would see us like driving in every day. And so they might have been lying in wait this whole time. And the night before, like I said, they beat a man to death. The cops probably shouldn't have told us that, but they did. It's hard to imagine when you're used to a fairly professional police force to encounter. And it's like nobody thought to tell us that they were like looking for these men earlier in the day.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. Anyways, you know, so here we are in South Africa. We ended up not continuing to live out on the reserve, but we did continue to work out on the reserve and teach out there, which that was difficult. I'll say it was pretty difficult because, of course, every time you go back there, you see the cracked windows, stuff like that. We knew where that came from. But every time a cohort of students came in, we weren't allowed to tell them what had happened, you know. And so, I had all these murderous, like angry, vengeful thoughts, and I'm ex-military and I know how to, you know, take care of business. I'll just put it that way. And so I had thoughts about setting traps and basically trying to bait people into breaking into our house so that I could carry out my vengeance. But there's a part of my brain that goes, this isn't who you are. And so there's this real turmoil and guilt that I started to experience because every time I'd have these flashbacks, I'd start to, it's in a sense reliving, wanting to take back what was taken from me. And the sort of primal basal instinct is to try to, in the same way that something was taken from me, inflict that on somebody else, you know, hurt people. And, you know, there was more incidents that happened in the time that we stayed there for another four and a half months before ultimately we decided we had to leave. Like we just couldn't stay there anymore. I was going to have a nervous breakdown or I was going to kill somebody or both. It just, either way, it wasn't going to end well. And so we had to leave for the sake of like both of our mental health, because we weren't sleeping at night. Like one of us would sleep, one of us would be awake. We have weapons by our bed, panic buttons for armed security. Like it's just, it's no place to live and try and be human. And so, but there came a point in time in my experience, about 8 months after the incident, we were back living with my brother in Turkey. My brother lives in Istanbul, Turkey. And I couldn't sleep one night. And I realized that if I wanted to be free from all of like the anger and the rage and the desire for vengeance and all of this, which I really felt was poisoning me, but I didn't know how to get away from it. It just kept coming. And, you know, I'd been through some trauma counseling, so I had a degree of understanding of like what was taking place in my brain, but it didn't make these things go away. I realized that if I was going to be set free from this experience, that I needed to forgive these men. Yeah. Now, how do you forgive people who would do this again if they saw me? No, this wasn't about me. It wasn't about Jonathan. I say that I was a representation of something they felt had historically oppressed them, and they felt justified in their actions. And so that's really in a nutshell what it boils down to. And so I had to ask the question, what must have happened in their life that led them to the place where they found themselves in this situation committing murder? Because I don't think human beings are born wanting to be murderers. You know, call me naive or overly optimistic, but I don't think we're born either racist or wanting to murder other people. And so something must have taken place. And I mean, if you know South Africa and its history, it's not just a white-black thing. There's eight different ethnic black groups. They all hate each other. There's just an immense amount of violence that takes place there. These are likely traumatized men doing what they felt they needed to do. And so every time I thought about what they did to me, and I could kind of feel like the rage starting to boil up and whatnot, I tried to counter that by cultivating a sense of compassion for what would have led them to being in the place where they did this to me. Also, you know, to understand that, like, forgiveness is not about absolving them. It wasn't about absolving them of their crimes. That's something they have to answer for. But it was about me letting go of any desire for vengeance, but actually also not asking God to smite them, essentially, or to carry out vengeance on my behalf. Because it's one thing to say, I'll forgive them, but God, you can smite them. That's not forgiveness. And so I realized if I wanted to be set free, I had to completely forgive and not actually, and have the faith to leave it in God's hands altogether, where I'm like, you know them, you know their hearts, you know the story. I don't know it. It has to be in your care. You do what is righteous, you know? And so it was kind of a journey to get to this place where I was maybe able to do that and to forgive them. Like, it's not like you make a decision or made a decision to forgive and the next day everything was tickety boo. It was a process of every time it would come up, reminding myself and deliberately cultivating that compassion for them and, you know, expressing my desire to forgive them. Like, I never saw these men again. I was requested to go back to South Africa for the court case because they had committed murder. They actually, you know, captured three out of these four men. They managed to get three of them, and they wanted me to go back and testify at that court case. And I was like, I'm not going back. You know, I kind of had enough. We'd actually went back one time after the incident back to South Africa and went to Cape Town for a period of time. But so I was able to, you know, this experience taught me a lot about forgiveness, because it's easy to forgive people who say they're sorry. It's a totally different story to forgive people that might actually have no remorse, but to understand that forgiveness is still necessary. And that might be, maybe even that's a controversial thing to say. And I don't, you know, I'm open to people disagreeing with me, but ultimately for me to be free, to no longer carry around thoughts of rage and violence and vengeance and anger, I had to completely forgive and be at peace with what had happened to me. And that was what I did. One of the next challenges I faced, though, was I became a binge eating food addict. Because I'm Christian, I didn't turn to drugs or alcohol, because I at least recognized the danger in my mental state of, like, turning to either of those. Food was socially acceptable. And so,
isn't that crazy that food is socially acceptable and yet it's one of the most abused drugs that there are? Yeah. I mean, I never turned to drugs or alcohol because I had parents that were addicted and I was afraid of becoming like them. So people think, oh, you're so strong, you never did drugs and you don't have a problem with alcohol. And it wasn't my strength that kept me from it. It was my fear of becoming like my father that kept me from it. So it's interesting people's perspective. And yes, I mean, having hard things happen in your life and the desire to escape them, even for a short time, is a very common, normal reaction to a lot of different traumas, severe traumas like you went through, or, I mean, even just hating your job and having it feel like it's sucking the life out of you. Yeah. I understand the craving, the desire to escape. I understand that. And I think that you can speak to this far more than I can, but one of the issues with the obesity epidemic or even overweight epidemic, especially here where I am in the US, I think it's higher than anywhere in the world that's what I'm aware of anyway, that food is such an acceptable drug of choice, right? So yeah. Jump into that. You can binge all you want and no one's going to think it's weird.
Yeah. Well, I gained a lot of weight rapidly after what had happened to me. And prior to that, I'd been fairly athletic. You know, I lifted weights, played basketball, like I was in pretty good shape. And so then there for a while, there was actually just this sense of denial of reality. I kind of felt like I was I was trapped in this body, but it wasn't who I was. And then came like all the feelings of shame and guilt and self-loathing, really, for who I'd become, because I'm like, this isn't who I am, in a sense. And some of the eating even would go as far as I would call it spite eating, So I was so angry at my body for how I felt like it had betrayed me or wouldn't do what I wanted it to do, that I would like, that I would eat out of anger and spite towards my own body. Like that is, so to think about, like, that's where I had got to kind of in my own like struggles around myself, my body with food and so on. And I adopted the identity of the jolly fat guy. There comes a point where it, you know, you've tried a few things to lose weight, or more than a few in my case, and nothing seems to stick. And I started to feel like I'm just going to be fat. Like that's it. I'm going to be fat for the rest of my life. So I might as well enjoy it. And so I really started to take on this jolly fat guy identity. I mean, even earned the nickname the Garburator. But it's like, hey, John's here. We got some extra, you know, extra burger patty. You want that? Hey, we got, you know, few John, you'll clean those up. And, you know, it kind of became, you know, because I'm a pretty social guy. My wife and I are pretty social. It became this thing where people would, without realizing it, actually be enabling me, knowing that I had this big appetite. I was known for having a big appetite. You know, I ate like a seagull swallowing an apple. You know, just it was terrible. And people would unwittingly be sort of facilitating this. And my wife, you know, she's been by my side through all of this. And it's like, I really, you know, I couldn't say that I'd still be here today doing what I'm doing if it wasn't for her, her patience, her compassion, her refusal to give up on me, actually, because there even came a point in time where I told her to leave me. I was so distraught over who I'd become that I told her to leave me and go back home to Australia because she'd be happier than being stuck with me. That was where things got to. But thankfully she could see through those words. And she was like, no, I know who you are and I'm not leaving you. And she wouldn't give up on me. And I can't, you know, like there's not really words to express my gratitude for her and her willingness. And so I'm fiercely loyal to her. Because in the absolute worst of my worst, she wouldn't leave me, even though I told her to. And so, you know, I get a little misty-eyed when I think about it, but like, that's the amazing human being that she is. And it's like, that's, you go back to our love story. Like I knew there was something from the day that we met. And so here we are, you know, and maybe God knew that I needed her to help me get through all of these things. So then you go to, well, how do you, you know, at some point in time, I was like, I can't keep living like this. Cause, there also was, you know, the anxiety attacks, the depression that comes after anxiety. You know, it doesn't look like clinical depression. I probably wouldn't have got diagnosed as clinically depressed, but I would go through these panic attacks, multiple panic attacks a day. And, you know, I tried to hide that from my wife for a while because, you know, being a man and I kind of associated them with weakness. And I remember a doctor just saying to me, just sitting down and going, look, we got nothing. Like there isn't anything that we can do to fix this. You have to change how you're living. Something has to change. Because also in this, so now I'm trying to run, you know, we've glossed over a few details for the sake of time, but like I'm trying to run a business, working 12 to 14 hours a day, trying to be a husband, trying to train a couple hours a day, sleeping maybe 5 hours a night, living on caffeine, energy drinks, pre-workout, that kind of stuff. Like I was just driving my nervous system into the ground and probably on the verge of a nervous breakdown. And this doctor says to me, like, you can't keep living like this. You can't, something has to change.
Yeah.
And I'd tried hiring coaches. What a frustrating experience that was. You know, and it's not a knock on these coaches. They did the best they could with what they had, but they were not equipped to help a person like me. Here's your macros. Here's your meal plan. Here's your training plan. Why aren't you following the plan? You know better than this. You know, kind of the shame, guilt, coercion cycle. And I'm like, I just wanted to scream so many times, like, you don't get it. You don't understand. And this, you know, it's true. They didn't understand what it's like to be me and the role that food played in my life and battling food addiction. And, you know, I mean, I picture like, you know, sitting in my car in a parking lot, eating a pizza and then going home and pretending like I just ate like a tiny meal, like, oh, I'll just have a little bit for dinner tonight. And, you know, I'm struggling so hard. I can't seem to lose weight. Life is so unfair and all this, mind you, I'm binge eating in secret, you know? So, yeah.
Yeah. So I did fitness competitions, and there was a woman, like, I had my own workout time, but we got to know people and we did posing classes and stuff together.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
'Cause that's what I did after my hysterectomy, when I felt like I needed to regain control of my life and work through the emotions of it, which is a lot of what you're talking about, working through the emotions of it. And I remember one of the women, like, she was getting up in the middle of the night eating peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. So she was following the program perfectly, right? The workouts, the diet, the like everything, she's following perfectly. Oh, and by the way, getting up at like 2 and like binging PB&Js and just omitting that part. And when it came out, you shouldn't shame a person for that. You know what I mean? So there's an emotional aspect that's not being dealt with the people you're with. Okay.
Yeah. And so I was probably ready to give them coaches, because I was like, I thought happiness would lie in looking like they looked. So often I would maybe, you see this coach and they look really fantastic, and oh my gosh, they have such a great physique. They must know what they're doing, clearly. And this is not a knock on all these coaches out there. They're well-meaning and well-intentioned and want to help people, but it's like, except that you've lived this struggle, you can't understand it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, finally I hired a coach. It was kind of like maybe a last ditch thing. It was going back to about 2017. And I'd had an insurance assessment for like life insurance, and they had to put a rider on my life insurance because I was at risk of heart attack, diabetes. I had high blood pressure. And so here I was at like 30, 35, 36 years old. And it's like, you need extra riders on your life insurance. You have to pay a higher premium because you're going to probably die sooner.
Yeah.
Oof. That one said, that was hard. Yeah. So
what did you do that was the biggest catalyst? Because I mean, you went from being, like, your story's incredible. You went from this nanotechnology chemist to a Navy engineer. Okay, let's have two incredible careers, right? And then you teach and you travel 45 countries on 5 continents with your wife, teaching English, living what lots of people would think is a dream. I mean, myself included, that would be like, sign me up for that action, right?
Yeah,
you're globetrotting, you're a nomad, you're teaching, you're spending more time with your wife. And by the way, we didn't mention this before, but kudos for realizing that in the Navy, you weren't spending enough time with your wife and that she was a higher priority. I think sometimes we prioritize our work because we're making money and we're providing, and especially for men, like the hunter-gatherer provider, right? And and good for you for recognizing that time was better. Yep. So you do this incredible journey after a really traumatic event where it was an attempted murder. You gain all this weight and you're on this journey to try to basically find yourself again, like reconnect with the person you used to be with some changes. So obviously now you're a coach with your own business and weight loss, and now this is coming clear to everyone else. So bridge the gap to me. What are the things that you did that made the biggest significant difference? What was it that finally made you lose 100 pounds and keep it off? And then I know your why, your passion to becoming a coach to help other people because of your struggle. What is that like now, helping other people? So I know that was a lot to throw at you, but
yeah. Oh, I mean, I absolutely love it. This is my calling. If anything was ever a calling, this is my calling. People look at my job history and wonder like why I've gone through so many jobs. And it's like, because ultimately I was actually just running from this thing that I have to do, that I can't do anything else. Like there is no other thing that I can do in my life anymore, in a sense. Like that's how passionate I am, how much I love it, but like also how necessary I think it is, because there's such a need. And you're asking about what was the catalyst. And really, I say one question changed my life. So it was this coach that I hired, and he asked me this question. He said, Jonathan, if you make a list of all the things you love and value, how far down that list do I have to go before I see your name?
Did you even put your name on that list?
No.
Right.
That question I mean, I was speechless. I was like, I'm not even on the list.
Yeah.
Yeah. So for me, I all of a sudden I've got to try and learn and figure out what is self-love. I knew what self-loathing was. I knew what hating myself was. I knew what spiting myself was. And here he is saying, you need to learn to love and value yourself. How do you do that when, like, historically, culturally, whatever, even through the military training and so on, it's all about being selfless. And mm-hmm. it felt so incredibly conflicting with my sense of identity in that moment to go, I need to start learning how to love myself. But that was actually the catalyst to actually start to make myself a priority. Because the other thing is, I'm pretty well educated, pretty switched on.
Yeah.
And one of the things I grappled with was, how can I know all of this stuff and can't help myself? How could I successfully, I was successfully coaching people when I was over 300 pounds because I'm a born coach. It's what I do. How could I do that? And I couldn't help myself. I was tortured inside, but it really started with this self-love and self-compassion piece, which we almost never hear men talk about. But compassion is not a get out of jail free card. That's not what it is, but it's understanding the human struggle. And that in the process of trying to create change, we are going to struggle. We're going to make mistakes. We're going to fall on our face. We're going to fall into old behavior patterns. And all of that's okay. That's a part of the process of growth and change. And we really can't have change without it. So, it you know, people ask, one, how long did it take to lose 100 pounds? And I tell them, like, 6 years. And I say, look, the truth is, if I knew now, then what I know now, it wouldn't take 6 years, right? But hey, that was it. And the other thing is they would like to know what did you do? What, you know, right. As though there's this roadmap, and look, your roadmap's going to look different than my roadmap. But I like to say that awareness, compassionate awareness, is the first step to change. So many of our behaviors actually become sort of habitual or automatic or get relegated to the midbrain or the primal brain. So we don't consciously even think about it. You could think about, you know, if we were to put that, you know, that UV spray that they use in CSI on your feet, yeah. and shine yeah. that light on it at nighttime and see the pattern of footprints in your house going to and from your kitchen, fridge, pantry, that kind of thing, we'd see there's automatic patterns of behavior that are taking place there. And so the first step is, and I really say compassionate awareness is key. Why? Because awareness might just make us retreat in shame and guilt. If you shine a light on my ugly behaviors that are problematic, I might just get angry and retreat. But if you can look at them in the light of compassion, and this is, I say, what I do with my clients, let's wrestle with your demons in the light. You can bring anything to me, and I will never use your struggles to judge you. I will never use them as ammunition against you, because I know exactly what it feels like to struggle. And so that's what we do. Because in the process of trying to create change, we're going to struggle. Our brain is going to fight, because change is inherently uncomfortable. And our primal brain wants us to avoid all discomfort and remain the same.
Right. Even at the expense of ourselves.
Yeah. But our soul says, I want to grow. I want to develop. I want to become better. I want to aspire to something greater. There's something in us that wants us to do more. And so ultimately, I kind of half jokingly say, like, nutrition is my cover story. It's not the real work.
Right.
But I meet people where they're at. Hey, I want to lose weight. Awesome. I'll help you lose weight. And then, you know, somewhere in the journey, something goes click and they go, oh, this wasn't about weight loss. Oh yeah. Funny that. You know, I wish I could just say, like, side effects might include weight loss.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Well, yeah. I mean, you coach specifically in weight loss, and I coach women in transformation and trauma, and they're very connected.
They are.
So yeah. All I'm doing is focusing on getting women through the trauma, which has, you know, you have to pick topics. Okay. You pick topics that you talk about, but really it comes down to the relationship with yourself.
Yeah.
100%. Every coach, no matter what you're doing, it is actually coming down with the relationship. You're helping the person with the relationship with yourself. Yeah. You can't advertise that.
No,
because that's not the presenting problem. Your presenting problem is weight loss.
Yes.
My presenting problem is women who are not happy with their life, but they've checked all the boxes. You know, I mean, So, and there's guilt and there's fear and there's failure and there's shame and insert thing here, right?
Yeah.
If, if you had to give your younger self advice, or I want to talk about, I'm gathering my thoughts. Let's end with, we know your ideal client is someone who wants to lose weight, probably understands that at least in part, it's about what's going on internally, emotionally for them. And they're willing to do that work. And that's the hard work.
Yeah. Yeah. That's okay. The uncomfortable stuff. And that's why coaching is so valuable, truthfully, is because it connects to another human being and gives you the space to be vulnerable, because isolation and vulnerability don't mix.
No, they're not synonymous at all. So what is the thing that people present with the most, which doesn't have to be, I want to get rid of my emotional baggage so I can lose weight, because that's not what they're saying. What is the presenting problem? Who are your ideal clients? And then where can we find you?
Yeah, they're largely women. And, you know, I didn't set out to be a coach of females, but this is my message seems to resonate the best with females. Typically, they're going to be over 35, usually very often mothers, actually, with children and balancing a professional career. They've tried multiple times to lose weight only to regain the weight back. And so they're the classic yo-yo dieter. But there's just something that's been kind of left unaddressed. And so you'll hear people say, I've tried everything and nothing works. I know what to do, but I can't seem to do it. So it's people that have, they've tried and they feel like they're the problem or they're the failure. So weight loss is the goal, but they seem like I've tried multiple times and nothing seems to work for me. I'm like, cool, let's have a conversation. Like, it's going to be a really interesting one.
And then what's the biggest piece of advice you can give someone to start their journey now on their own?
I go back to that compassionate awareness piece. So start becoming aware of your behaviors and don't use it as a way to judge yourself. So it could be as simple as taking photos of your meals. The simple act of doing something like that means you're now going to eat that meal with a little bit more awareness. So acknowledging everything that you eat and maybe even acknowledging why you eat it and trying to do it without judgment. Like, if you're going to eat it because you want to eat your feelings, then say, this is why I'm eating it. So really that awareness piece, because again, a lot of our behaviors take place from the midbrain or the primal brain at the back of our brain. And we want to bring it to the prefrontal cortex, the front part of our brain, the place of conscious awareness. It's only in that space that we can actually start to create change. So just start becoming aware of your almost unconscious patterns of behavior and the narratives you tell yourself around them. That's really going to be the first step to creating change.
Where can people find you the easiest?
Freedomnutritioncoach.com, I would say.
We've already put it in there. And we talked at the beginning, I want to wrap it up at the end, that you do a free strategy call, which is a get to know you and ask questions. And yes, you're a coach. And yes, they can hire you. Sometimes, though, that conversation can be pretty enlightening. John, thank you so much for sharing your story. So much.
Yeah, and thank you for the work that you do, even for holding space for conversations like this. I think you've probably had many, many valuable conversations that have really touched many lives. And so very often the thanks go one way, and I think they should also go the other way as well.
Awesome. Thank you. Thank you for investing your time with me on At a Crossroads with the Naked Podcaster. I'm so glad that you joined in the conversation. It would be amazing if you would share this episode with someone you think can benefit from it. All guests' links and audience freebies are available on the podcast page of momof18.com. This podcast was designed to help you in your struggles. So reach out and let me know what you enjoy and what you would like to see more of. It will support me on the journey to causing a worldwide epidemic of healing, gratitude, and joy. Until next time, remember, you're not alone in your struggle. Reach out to me on any platform. I love to connect. You are worth it to me.